want to say at the outset that the Constitution of our country is not a religious document, but its very concept is based upon a religious understanding. By that I mean this. Our early founding leaders found themselves aware of the fact, and largely in concert with the results of the Great Awakening, that man was essentially a sinner, and if he did not have parameters of guidance around him, he would rampantly practice his sin. Now, there are three documents that come historically in sequence in the period of our history that leads up to the Constitution. One was the Declaration of Independence, followed then by the Articles of Confederation, followed then by the Constitution. We're most familiar with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Most of us don't have much familiarity with the Articles of Confederation. Declaration of Independence was a document that was drafted largely in reaction to the opposition to English rule, and it was with a semi-understanding of theology, if I can say that. It was largely patterned after deist. Thomas Jefferson, the prominent person there, was a deist. He was not really a believer. And I say that not with judgment, by testimony of his life and by way of his own statements of declaration. And so there was a belief in an existence of God, but there was not a belief that God continued to have a part in the affairs of man. It was what we call a closed system. And so within a deistic framework, Jefferson and those that around him drafted the Declaration of Independence saw man as essentially in need of some help, but not depraved. Did not believe in total depravity. So if you will, you sort of see man as sick, but not dead. And so that reflects itself in the Declaration of Independence. Man can manage life on his own. We can be independent. We can do this. Now, there are references to God in those documents, and I don't want to disdain those, but you have to contextually understand what are meant by those documents. You come to the Articles of Confederation. That's the particular document that was drafted immediately following the success of the War of Independence. And my reference to that is just in passing, but the Articles of Confederation were drafted by the early leaders as a means of trying to say, how are we going to govern ourselves once we now have removed ourselves from English control? Articles of Confederation go one step further, and they see man as essentially good. And so, frankly, if you trace the history of our country, the most precarious point in our history is not the present. It was the years immediately following the Revolution. We were a country that was at risk of having total chaos with every man doing right in his own eyes. After all, we're now independent. You know, the truth is, independence is not the absence of law. It's the understanding of the governance through law. It's like Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The perfect law of liberty. I love that combination, the perfect law of liberty. And so the Articles of Confederation, without a spiritual reference point, but really a very humanistic document, finds itself, the Articles of Confederation were such that they said, basically, you know, we're drafting this arrangement whereby every man has his own freedom and every man can do whatever they want and there was no accountability. So the colonists within them, what had previously been the colonies, eventually become the states, they were so antagonistic to each other, they were at odds with each other. Separate militia, separate currency, charging fees to move from one state border to the other. We were a country of chaos. And that particular chaos arrested the attention of some spiritually minded leaders that were still the product of the Great Awakening. And they brought together then a constitutional congress, which if you trace the participants in the Articles of Confederation and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, there's largely different components of membership to those three gatherings. Some overlap very little, but the constitutional congress gathering was largely under the dominance of spiritually minded persons who said, just like the Bible is an outside source that dictates how we ought to live, we need a document that's an outside source that dictates how we should govern. And so in that sense, it's a biblically based or patterned document, the Constitution is, but it is not a spiritually inspired document. I point that out to say that we are indebted to those spiritually minded leaders, and among those, a very significant voice that we herald with reference often in this time of our constitutional chapel. John Leland was a man who was a Baptist preacher in Virginia who had been selected by the Virginia colony, or the Virginia state, as we'd say, to represent the Constitutional Congress, and he found himself deeply burdened to put together a series of stipulated privileges, which we now call the Bill of Rights. those first 10 amendments, I don't know if you've ever stopped to think about it, but were the only constitution in modern history and maybe ever that ever was adopted that already had amendments to it. When you start a document, you start a church someday, you'll draft a constitution and you'll have an article that says if we ever want to change this constitution, here's how the amendments can be added to our constitution. But you don't start with amendments. But our constitution did. We call it the Bill of Rights. And we cherish those privileges. We owe it to a Baptist preacher who drafted that document and, recognizing his own lack of voicing significance as he would go to that Congress, actually yielded his seat to a more worthy and famous voice on one term. I'll let you have my office to go as the representative from Virginia so long as you promise that these will be added to the Constitution. And it's through that particular vehicle that we enjoy today the wonderful privileges that we so quickly herald, and sometimes they are abused, called, the Bill of Rights. Now, with that backdrop, I just want to read one paragraph before introducing our speaker, who is the prominent part of our Constitution Chapel today. But on September 17, and this, incidentally, is a copy of our Constitution. It's pocketable. I want you to know that. I don't herald this with a sense of trying to reverence a person, but that is something that Senator Byrd was famous for, wasn't it? For having the Constitution always in his pocket. And I turn to our friend, because you'll see why in a moment, his familiarity with the political scene. But on September 17, 1787, the Constitutional Convention came to a close in the Assembly Room of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There were 70 individuals chosen to attend the meetings with the initial purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. Just reference that document. Rhode Island opted to not send any delegates. Anybody from Rhode Island here? God bless you, you heathen. No. 55 men attended most of the meetings. There were never more than 46 present at any one time. And ultimately, only 39 delegates signed that document. William Jackson, who was the secretary of the convention, but not a delegate, also signed the Constitution. John Delaware was absent, but had another delegate sign for him. While offering incredible contributions, George Mason of Virginia, Edmund Rudolph of Virginia, and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts refused to sign the final document because of basic philosophical differences. Mainly, they were fearful of an all-powerful government and wanted a Bill of Rights added to protect the rights of the people. And then we list the people that follow. But may I just tell you, that particular exercise, September 17, 1787, did not come without great consternation and challenge. We sit here today and comfortably reference it, have access to it, can pocket it conveniently, but can I tell you, we are indebted to those who paid the price. And so today it's our privilege to continue that honor as we thank the Lord for our country and the freedoms that we enjoy. It's our distinct privilege today to have a godly representative from the arena of politics who represents our state. Speaker Tim Armstead serves as the Speaker of the House of Delegates here in West Virginia, has served in political responsibilities for the past 18 years, and is just a very dedicated believer. It's my privilege last winter to have the opportunity to serve as a filling-in preacher, I suppose somewhat of an interim pastor at Elkview Baptist Church in the Charleston area, where Tim is a member. And I reference him that with both honor and yet a sense of real privileged friendship. He's a wonderful servant of the Lord, and I've asked him to come today and address from his heart just what he has for us in this occasion when we do reflect upon the Constitution of our country, the privilege that we have to be godly citizens in the midst of this. And I hope as a result of this, whether you're from West Virginia or not, that today you will find your heart grateful for representatives like Speaker Armstead, who comes today to share for us as a dedicated servant of the Lord.
Let me just say what an honor and privilege it is to be here with you today. It's an honor and privilege to be in the legislature and to be the speaker, but it's also one of the greatest opportunities I have in that role to be able to talk to students, and I love to do that. That's just one of the things that I've always enjoyed doing. And as I was thinking about that today, I hope if you'll give me just a little bit of forbearance here about talking about my personal story a little bit, because maybe some of you are sort of in the same boat that I was, so to speak, back when I was in college, in high school and college. I accepted the Lord when I was 12 years old. And as I went through high school, I was fortunate to be in a very small church that had an Awana program, if you're familiar with that program. But at that point, they had a high school Awana program. And at one point during my time going through that Awana program, there was an assignment as part of that. And that was to talk about, and this was probably when I was a sophomore or junior in high school, talk about what I wanted to do as far as a profession. And at that point, I am a lawyer. I didn't intend to be at that point. That wasn't really where I was necessarily thinking I was going at that point. But I did that assignment, and part of that assignment was I talked about that I would like to be in government, that I thought, I was fascinated by politics, by government, and I wrote that was, you know, what I would like to look at doing in life. And one of the leaders, or one of the leaders at that time, took me aside and they said, well, you know, that's great. You do realize that's kind of a very worldly kind of something that not too many Christians go into, and you just need to be aware. And they weren't necessarily trying to be discouraging, but in some ways I think they were discouraging to me when they said, you know, that's when you get into government and those types of things, you know, that's politics, that's a hard life to be in, and that's kind of rough, and, you know, you just need to think about that. So, I did, and I started thinking, well, you know, is there a place for Christians in politics? Is that, something that Christians should be involved in? And when I got into college, someone gave me a book that I've read several times since then. It was written by Chuck Colson, who, you know, I don't know if you know Chuck Colson's story, but he was in the Nixon White House, and he ended up going to prison, sort of somewhat connected to Watergate. But he became a Christian during that time. And he wrote a book after he was released from prison, talking about, and the title of it was Kingdoms in Conflict, and it was about, you know, what we as Christians, what our allegiance is to God, and how that is balanced with our allegiance to our nation, to our Constitution, to our government. And it was a very fascinating book, and I'd certainly commend it to you to read if you have an interest in that. But as I read that, he talked about how a Christian can serve in government, how a Christian can truly fulfill their allegiance, so to speak, to God, their obligations to our nation as a Christian. And that was a very eye-opening book to me because it really answered a lot of the questions that I was struggling with. Because are there times as Christians that our government may demand something of us or expect something of us, and at the same time, God expects something different? And that is becoming more and more a problem, I think, in our nation, a challenge to Christians. But let me say that if you go back to when that is becoming a challenge, I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that that's what our founding fathers intended. They did not intend for Christians to feel alienated from their own government or from the expectations of their government. They expected that constitution that they wrote, that Dr. Anderson spoke of so eloquently, that they expected that to be something that we could fulfill our duties as Christians. And in fact, John Adams, our second president, our first vice president, our second president, said, "Our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." So it was clearly their intent that our Christian values, our Christian beliefs, were incorporated into our Constitution. And as you go through, and Dr. Anderson spoke of the Declaration of Independence, that we were endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that was the basis, that was the standard. And that as we went into drafting our Constitution, the one thing that really, as I've studied it, has become more and more evident to me is, and I hope this is one thing we think about today as we honor our Constitution, is that our Constitution does not grant us rights. Our Constitution protects the rights that we are granted by God. We have a right of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and so many other liberties that we've given, we're being given. But we've not been given those by our government. We've been given those by God. And the Constitution is there to protect those, not to grant them. Because if it can grant them, it can also take them away. And there really is no way that any government can take away our God-granted liberties and rights as individuals. So as I've looked at the history, somewhat of our Constitution, and you've heard a lot, I'm sure, about the concept of separation of church and state. Obviously, that is not in our Constitution. That is not a phrase that's included in our Constitution. Many people think it is, but it really isn't. And it has been, to my opinion, very seriously misinterpreted throughout the history of our nation, because I don't believe that God intended, or our founding fathers intended, that we would not, as we fulfill our duties and our obligations as American citizens, that we would somehow leave our beliefs and our values as a Christian at the door. And I don't believe that's what's intended in terms of our government, those who serve in government, or just as us as citizens. Because if you look back in the history of how that came about and how that phrase came about, there was actually in a letter that, it wasn't in our Constitution, but it was in a letter that was written by Thomas Jefferson. And as Dr. Anderson said, there certainly was a concern when Thomas Jefferson became president of the United States, because many Christians believed, because of his deistic beliefs, that he would not stay true to Christian values in terms of his presidency. In fact, there are stories of people actually burying their Bibles in their backyard because they believed that Thomas Jefferson may take them away from them. And in order to, I believe, in some ways, to kind of respond to those fears and to allay those fears, Thomas Jefferson responded to a letter that was written to him by a congregation, a Baptist congregation in Connecticut. And that is where he used the phrase separation of church and state, a wall of separation of church and state. So we hear that a lot, but you don't really hear it in the context that he wrote it. And if I could just take a minute to share with you some other language of that letter that I think really clarifies what was meant by that phrase. He said, and I don't like to be read to, so I'm sorry I'm reading to you, but I can't memorize all of this very well, so let me read you what he said in this letter. It says, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation on behalf of the rights of conscience, I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all his natural rights, convinced he has no natural rights in opposition to his social duty." So I think what this was saying was not that we need to build this wall so that Christians can never express their beliefs in the public arena, that they have to separate those from their obligations to our country. I don't believe that's what he was saying at all. I think what he was saying, and what I believe our Constitution truly assures us, is that the Constitution will not allow your government to prohibit you from exercising your beliefs and your rights as a Christian to worship and to actually express your values in your lifestyle, in your day-to-day life, that your Christian values cannot be infringed upon by your government. And I think that's what the phrase within the Constitution was there to assure us. Again, not granting us any rights, but protecting the rights that God has given us. So as Dr. Anderson talked about the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, the right to express, again, not the right granted, but the protection of your right to express your beliefs, your religious beliefs, along with your free speech, your rights of assembly, your rights of free speech. But, you know, I always like to share this bit of trivia, because particularly with college students, because I think this is kind of an inspiration to maybe those who are in college. If you look back at the history of our Bill of Rights, there were actually 12 amendments that were offered originally, not just the 10 that were adopted. There were 12. And there were two of them. One of them has never been adopted. The 12 that were proposed, one of them was never adopted. But one of them, in addition to the 10 that were adopted, was, and this will be your trivia for the day. You can like share this with someone at some point in your life and look like you really, you know, studied this Constitution. But the other amendment was an amendment that said that Congress could never raise their salary unless that salary kicked in after they were reelected. So they couldn't raise their salary during their own term. It had to kick in the next term so that there would be an election between then. And that amendment was not adopted with the other 10. But a college student started researching this back in the late 80s, a law student, and realized that there's nothing that stops you from continuing to adopt an amendment to the Constitution if it's already, that process has already started. So he picked it up from where they left off in the late 1790s and started an effort to get other states to adopt it. So that amendment was actually adopted in 1992. The 27th Amendment to the Constitution is now a part of our Constitution. But it was part of the Bill of Rights that was never actually adopted. So it took nearly 200 years to get that amendment through to the Constitution. So there's your trivia for the day. The 27th Amendment started with the Bill of Rights and got completed as the last amendment that's been adopted to our Constitution in 1992. But at any rate, those amendments to the Constitution, the first 10, the Bill of Rights, were amended and adopted because many felt like that there was almost an interpretation of our Constitution that it did grant us rights instead of protect rights we were already had. And so many, including those that Dr. Anderson talked about, were very concerned about that and felt like that they could not support the adoption of our Constitution unless it was clear that these rights were inalienable rights granted by God and that the Constitution needed to protect those rights, not grant those rights. Or have any ability to ensure, to allow our government to take those rights away at any time. So, having said that, with that history in mind, to me, as a member of the legislature, I've heard people get on the floor and talk about that we have to be a secular government, that we have to ensure that everything we pass is secular, that it cannot have any type of religious connotation or even be based on a religious belief or a religious set of values. And that is, to me, absolutely false and a misinterpretation of our Constitution and the rights that it assures us as Christians and as Americans. And I think we have seen, unfortunately, over the past few decades, in your lifetimes, an erosion of the what the true meaning and intent of the Constitution is. And I hope that as we continue to fight back against that and to press back against that, that you will continue that as well, because I believe truly that the founders of our Constitution, the founders of our nation, and the writers, the drafters of our Constitution intended, as John Adams said, that Constitution was for a religious Christian nation, that we as Christians don't have to leave our beliefs at the door in order to fulfill the duties that our Constitution and the rights that our Constitution has protected. We have seen over the last few decades an interpretation of our Constitution that I believe is really misguided, that there are certain rights that our courts have said our Constitution grant that really aren't in that Constitution. In the 1970s, the supposed right to an abortion. In the most recent one, the right to same-sex marriage. That these are somehow rights that are granted in the Constitution. And I would say to anyone who believes that is a question in their mind, to to simply take the Constitution and read it yourself and see if any of those things are truly rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution. They just are not there. And they're not consistent with what I believe the framers of our Constitution meant. That, along with many others that have been determined to be quote-unquote constitutional rights, I just don't believe they are assured by our Constitution. And I think it's incredibly important that we be, as Christians, as I go back to what I started talking about, is what role we play as Christians in government, that we do need to be involved. Because if we are not involved, we're basically turning that over to people who do not share our values to make those decisions, whether that's judges, whether that's a president, whether that's a judge, whether that's a member of Congress, that we need to make sure that we put people into those offices who will truly interpret our Constitution in the way that it was intended to be interpreted and will stand up for our Christian values in our country and make sure that they're protected. Not to say that everyone will in our country will espouse those values, will follow those values, but those of us who choose to do so should not worry that there are two kingdoms in conflict here, that we have to, in order to truly follow what we know God wants us to do, should not put us at odds with our own Constitution and our own government. And I think that as Christians, we can ensure that by making sure that the right people are there to make those decisions. So with that, let me close in a word of prayer and would ask and challenge each of us that as we go into an election cycle that you, I'm not endorsing or trying to say anyone in particular, but I think as we go through an election cycle, that it is our responsibility as Christians to look at the records, the values, and the positions of those people who we're going to be voting on, and ensure that they will uphold the Christian values that I think are protected by our Constitution, and that maybe someone in this room will feel led to step forward and become a part of our government in some fashion, whether that's your local government, whether that's your state government, federal government, whatever that role might be, that hopefully there will be people, men and women, who will step forward and stand up for the values that we know are important to our nation.